Welcome to MoneyWeb Now. Business news every morning.
It's Friday, 10 January. We've got US unemployment data due 3:30 our time. Expected, unchanged, 4.2%. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you loud and recorded from studios in Rosebank. On the show today, Chris Eddy from 10X Investment. We've had a stupendously excellent run in the US markets over the last couple of years, truthfully decade, but valuations are therefore skyrocketingly high. Should that make us concerned about returns over the next decade? And thoughts from me on when your medical aid rejects a valid claim. This podcast is brought to you by StanLib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Chris Eddy. 10X Investments is where you find him. Chris, I appreciate the time. Excellent returns from US equities. I think both 23 and 2024 were close on 30% for the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. Nice returns. Every investor is sitting there feeling quite smart about themselves if they had even just the index trackers. But historically, that tells us the next decade ahead might not be as good.
Hi, Simon. Yes, that's right. I mean, if you look cumulatively over the last 2 years, the S&P 500 delivered about a 58% total return.
Yeah.
But what's quite interesting is when you break it down, only 6% of that came from EPS growth. You got another 3% from divvies, and 49% was really driven purely by valuation expansion. And that really reflects a market that's pretty much moved ahead, well ahead of its earnings, entering bubble-like territory, if we're really honest here. Because over the longer term, you would really expect the market to track those earnings, sure, with some variability. Yeah. But we're at that point where it's really outstripped what we've actually seen from realized earnings. And if you look back really over about the last 10 years, like you say, I mean, the last decade, it really has been a US story. You've seen in dollar terms, real returns, so after inflation, of 10% per annum over the last decade. But really, I think the critical question now, as you rightly highlight, is can such exuberance continue, or are we really setting up for the start of really a less favorable regime over the next decade?
I want to touch a bit on the kind of continue in a bit, but the key thing here is that it's just the, you know, if we've got 6% EPS, 3% dividend, to your point, 10% would be a reasonable return. We're not saying there's going to be a market crash. We're not that talk at all. We're just saying over the next decade, you're probably going to struggle to do double-digit return in the US as sort of valuations normalize.
Yes, I mean, that's right. If you kind of close your eyes and open them over the next in 10 years' time. Mm. But we know that markets don't typically follow a straight line. So there's normally a lot of variability and volatility that one sees sort of over that path over the next 10 years. I mean, there are where we're sitting at from a valuation perspective today. I mean, you're sitting with the S&P 500, if we look at something like the cyclically adjusted PE ratio, mm-hmm. so the CAPE ratio, long-term valuation metric, you're sitting at about 37 times earnings, wow. which really has only been exceeded once in history, and that was during the 2000 dot-com bubble.
And you mentioned the bubble there, because I was going back, because a lot of folks, they're going to say to me this time it's different. And post that dot-com bubble, sort of the decade that followed, what the S&P did, I think, 1% CAGR, the NASDAQ did a slightly negative CAGR. I mean, we're not talking crazy stuff. We're just talking, this is how markets roll out.
Yeah, I mean, that was a lost decade. And I think for many investors, if you look back in the rearview mirror over the last 10, 15 years, I don't think anyone even believes that kind of negative real returns from US equities is potentially even possible. But we've been there, and not so long ago, like you said, following that 2000 peak, where quite interestingly, the CAPE ratio peaked at about 44 times. So that's the one thing about looking at valuations. They don't really help you over the short term. Just because a market's expensive doesn't mean it can't get more expensive over the next 6 months, over the next 12 months even. But as you stretch that time horizon out over the next 5 to 10 years, it really creates a significant headwind going forward. I mean, there is the argument, which mm-hmm. is true, that much of The strong performance, certainly that we've seen over the last 2 years, has been significantly concentrated in the Magnificent Seven, driven by a lot of the sort of AI euphoria. And many people make the point that these are very profitable, cash-generative businesses. Sure. They're not like many of the speculative tech companies of the 2000s. But despite that, when the valuations really reach these extreme levels, the assumption that's embedded in that is that these companies will continue to dominate for multiple decades to come. And really, history's shown us that that assumption often proves wrong, whether it's due to other competition or regulation or even economic cycles. Because what's quite interesting, if you think about many of these sort of Magnificent Seven, they have been bucketed as quality companies following the COVID-like crash, which was a very weird and specific sort of event and recession, which really pushed the whole world online, which led these businesses to kind of almost gain that quality moniker, if you would, because they were really resilient in that economic downturn. But if you step back and you think about it, historically, advertising businesses and semiconductor companies have been some of the most pro-cyclical going back on record. And it'll be quite interesting to see how these businesses would hold up in sort of a normal garden variety recession.
I remember the .com, and there was a company, and for the moment escapes my, they basically sold networking equipment, and the growth that they'd had for 3 or 4 years, if it went on for the next 2 decades, they had revenue more than global GDP. My sense is almost it's the same with Nvidia. It's to your point. I mean, make no mistake, Nvidia makes some amazing things, but like, can they really do multiple trillions of revenue? And the answer is probably not. Which then says, is this an index construction concern in terms of concentration? My data only goes back 50 years, but the S&P, the top five, seems to have the highest concentration. Or is this indices kind of self-clean? We've seen it before. We've seen it locally with Anglo and miners at the turn of the century.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're talking about the Magnificent Seven, so let's sort of stick with that. Mm. They now account for about 33% of the S&P 500. If you had kind of tracked those seven shares in 2000, that number was sitting at about 22 times. So kind of call it roughly 50% more. So, and if you think about the premise of index investing, it is really to decrease idiosyncratic risk, and this concentration really actually does reduce the diversification and heightens the market or the index's reliance on a handful of companies to really drive the outcome for investors in that broad market. It's quite useful for context to do a little bit of an exercise around valuations, because in terms of really setting reasonable expectations as you look out forward, I mean, quite interestingly, 10 years ago, that CAPE ratio, which I said now is at 37 times, was at 21 times for the S&P 500. And over the last 10 years, we've seen fantastic EPS growth of about 4% per annum. And if you think about the environment, there's really been strong tailwinds. You've had corporate tax cuts from Trump's first term. You've had interest rates at zero, which really went a long way to support those 10% per annum real returns that we're talking about. But the big driver has been that CAPE ratio moving from 21 times to really 37 times. And if you had to say, okay, from this starting point, let's just assume we have another decade of really strong earnings growth of 4% per annum. To get the same 10% real returns, that CAPE ratio would really need to expand to an unprecedented 58 times. Wow. And that really kind of therein lies the problem. And if you flip that on its head and you say, well, okay, let's just make the assumption, still 4% real EPS growth. And let's say valuations revert to the average just of the last 20 years because there's structural changes in the economy. Okay. Real returns would drop just to 2% per annum. And if you had to say, potentially, if valuations revert back to kind of slightly longer term averages of, let's call it just 20 times, which is where we were 10 years ago, real returns could be negative at around about 3% per annum. So when you really combine the risks of elevated valuations, we've seen flat earnings over the last 2 years and quite elevated rates, specifically in the US, it really does paint a bit of a sombering picture, and the S&P 500 may well be headed for a lost decade.
Yeah, and again, we're not predicting a market crash on Tuesday. That's not the sense at all. But it does say to us that as a global investor, which all of us are one way or another, we need to look at reducing that U.S. exposure. And I have global ETFs, and if my memory serves, the U.S. used to be 50-odd% of those ETFs, and now it's up in the high 60s or 70s. We need to sort of pull back some U.S. exposure.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting when you're talking about the concentration within the U.S. market, because first of all, you are right. I mean, outside the U.S., we don't see as elevated valuations, barring one or two countries. I mean, along the similar theme as sort of Taiwan, which is dominated by TSMC, is kind of sitting at similar type valuation levels. And the other one that springs to mind is India. But barring that, in broad emerging markets, broad developed markets, ex the US, the valuation multiples certainly aren't as demanding. But what's quite interesting is even when you look within the US, outside of those seven large shares, mm-hmm. there are actually lots of other opportunities that aren't as demanding. I mean, you have the likes of a good way to diversify away from some of that heavy concentration is to look at something like the S&P 500 equal weight.
Yeah.
And what's quite interesting, over the last 10 years, it's actually delivered better earnings growth than the broad S&P 500. But its valuation multiple, its cap ratio has remained unchanged over the last 10 years. So it started the decade at 21 times mm-hmm. earnings. It's now at 21 times earnings in terms of that cap multiple compared to the S&P 500 that went from 21 to 37 times. So really, even within the US itself, diversifying away from that really expensive top-heavy part of the market can provide some interesting investment opportunities, not having to only look outside of the US.
I'd forgotten about equal weight ETFs. I'm a big fan of those for exactly as you said, and the numbers there say it does in the sticker. If we're getting low single digits out of the US, that brings bonds back into the party, because I can get 4.5% in a US 10-year.
Yeah, exactly. Bonds are certainly back. 4.5%, actually nearing closer to 5%, which is a marked improvement from where we were in 2021. I think the US 10-year hit a low of about 0.5% then. Which was quite interestingly the last time the cap ratio was sitting at around 37 times. So not only on an absolute basis, but also on a relative basis, bonds are certainly more attractive. And what's quite interesting, if you think about that environment that we've been in over the last sort of 3 to 4 years, inflationary environment going back a couple of years ago, bonds had kind of flipped the role that they typically play in a portfolio, because a positive correlation with equities meant that both equities and bonds were selling off together. So that ballast role that bonds typically played in a portfolio really disappeared. But what's quite interesting over the last 6 months is we've seen that negative stock-bond correlation come back into the portfolio. So not only do you have a better income and more meaningful income from investing in US bonds, there's that typical role that they play around sort of hedging equity risk in a portfolio is potentially starting to come back, which certainly makes the old boring staid 60-40 portfolio a more compelling value proposition today.
That was going to be my next question. 60% equity, 40% bonds, because of course that didn't work for an age when equities were flying and bonds were under pressure. But suddenly it's a case of, I mean, it's a blunt instrument, but it's a blunt methodology, but it can really work. And it gives you also, as you say, that lack of correlations back. In some senses, to your point, bonds are back and 60-40 should come with them.
And more so, I think, building on from that, just broader diversification in portfolios. Diversification, or I think you've seen many articles come out over the last 2-3 years talking about diversification.
Yeah.
Because if you haven't been invested in the US, in US equities, and you haven't been invested in kind of the Magnificent Seven, you've really lagged. It doesn't matter what you invested in, whether it was equities outside of the US, whether it was fixed income, commodities, etc. But I think, given the headwinds that we're talking about now, investors really need to, not only within their equity sleeve, but across their portfolio, ensure that there's diversification across different drivers of returns. And certainly there are different asset classes and different markets that certainly offer a better value than US equities at this point in time.
And that fits perfectly into my last question, which is around tactical exposure. So I always look at the idea, I've got a core of a portfolio, it will be a global ETF, it does what it says in the sticker, I've got some bonds, and then maybe I like resources, maybe I like Europe or whatever the case is. And these days, you've got that range of ETFs. I mean, does that work, or am I trying to be too clever?
Short-term market timing, as you know, is notoriously challenging. It's very, very difficult. And even more so, it's exceptionally difficult to consistently add value through doing that. People might find it intellectually stimulating, but adding value is very, very difficult. I think investors are really much more suited to extending out their time horizon, looking out over the next 5 years, looking out over the next 10 years. Doesn't mean you're not making changes to your portfolio. But really, when you are following a valuations type-based approach, which is really what we've been talking about today, it tells you nothing about the next 6 months. So if people are saying, I'm downweighting my exposure because of high valuations over the next 6 months, well, unfortunately, that doesn't really work. But if you're building a portfolio and allocating to different markets and asset classes with a longer-term view, looking out over the next 5 years, you certainly are able to generate better outcomes by allocating to assets and markets which have really not such heady valuations like the US at this point in time. And you'll probably be served not necessarily over the next 6 months, but looking out at the next 5 years, given sort of the bubble-like features that we're seeing in US market cap equities today.
Yeah, and maybe that's the key point, is lift our eyes and look out longer rather than worry about sort of Christmas time. Let's focus on Christmas 2030 or even 35. We'll leave it there. Chris Eddy, 10X Investments, always appreciate the insights.
Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for three decades.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Some Friday thought from me, medical aids. I think as soon as I said medical aids, everyone out there shakes their head and says, yep, we need them, but yo, are there any use really? Do they actually pay out? Well, here's the thing. So a year ago, my wife broke her wrist and submitted a claim. She had to have surgery and all of those sort of fun things, x-rays, rushed to hospital, and the medical aid basically rejected it all. Everything. But my wife's superpower is bureaucracy. So she fought the fight and, you know, they said this code was wrong and that was there. And ultimately, they paid. They paid it all. I smashed my foot this just Monday. Not nearly as bad as a broken wrist. It's just a smashed foot. And you know what? I'm waiting for the medical aid to reject everything. But here's the thing. And I'm not talking your doctor appointment or perhaps your prescription drugs and the like. I'm talking those sort of bigger events, those emergency events. Oftentimes, it's for simple reasons that you've been rejected. It's, you know, the codes are wrong, or, you know, the practice number, the PR number was incorrect or something. So short answer, when medical aid rejects my claim, I just, you know, shake my head and say, well, medical aid, what did you expect? Walk away. But don't. Fight it. Go back to them. Phone them. Say, hey, you've rejected it. What's the problem? And if they say, you know, no reason, well, then they must pay it. There has to be a reason why they've rejected it. You want to know what that reason is, and you can fix it. In the case of my wife, the codes were wrong. She went and got the codes changed, got the doctor to change it, went and got the form, sent it to the medical aid. It wasn't simple. It wasn't a walk in the park. It takes a lot more perseverance than I have for bureaucracy. But the point is that we pay the medical aid for those emergency medical scenarios. And when we want it, they must step up. And oftentimes, they put almost little pebbles in the way. Oh, wrong code. We pay nothing. Instead of just saying, look, code's wrong. Sort this out. Get back to us. They just decline it. So if you've got a big claim, it's declined, fight it. Fight it and go back to them. What's the problem? Correct it, resubmit it, carry on doing until eventually they pay you, truthfully, what they owe you.
The StanLib Flexible Income Fund delivers capital preservation and consistent top quartile inflation beating returns. Let your money keep working with StanLib Asset Management even after you retire.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
That's it for today. This podcast is brought to you by StanLib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Seren, Eddie, Nebuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again Monday. We'll be back live in studio.
Listen to the live stream of MoneyWeb Now at the same time every weekday. For more business, finance, and investment news. MoneyWeb Now. On the money. Also available on podcast.